present on minorities, class struggle, and the limits of philosophy. Then we will move on to Jonathan Martineau on temporal alienation and social acceleration. And then finally we have Juha Koivisto on a philosophical turn towards hegemonic politics, Hobbes, Locke, Shaftesbury, and Hume.
Okay,
we'll have 20 minutes each and then plenty of time after for discussion.
Cool. All right. Thank you very much for coming. Okay, so the first thing is I am changing the title of the paper a bit, but it's still about the limits of philosophy. So my name's Kai Herron. I'm at the University of Manchester. My research is on Marxism, psychoanalysis, and Deleuze, and environmental struggles. But today I'm going to talk about one of the questions that came up for this stream, specifically about, I think it was exactly worded, how is it possible to be a Marxist in philosophy today? So my original plan was to do that through Deleuze and Guattari's discussion of minorities, but instead I'm going to do it through their theory of revolution and time, so we might have something in common which could be interesting. So, yeah, I want to look at Deleuze and Guattari and their contributions to Marxist philosophy and politics, and in particular to thinking revolution and revolutionary situations. My overarching thesis, so if you miss anything else, just this bit, is that when it comes to the question of revolution, there are two Deleuze and Guattaris. A Deleuze and Guattari of becoming revolutionary without the actuality of the revolution, and a Deleuze and Guattari for whom the question of revolution remains entirely open and undecided. So this ambiguity, I want to suggest, is not the consequence of an internal inconsistency in Deleuze and Guattari's thought. It is the recording of a genuine political problem, of a concrete political ambiguity in philosophy. So the problem of how to think revolution today, specifically, I think. So it's this underscoring of this problem, both conceptually and practically, that I want to suggest Deleuze and Guattari make one of their most significant contributions to Marxist philosophy. To be more specific about this, for those of you who maybe aren't familiar with Deleuze and Guattari, the first one I want to draw out is characterized by an endless deferral of revolution in the name of a philosophy of resistance. So this is the Deleuze and Guattari of micropolitics, of everyday resistance, of becoming revolutionary, as radically disarticulated from the historical realization of the revolution. It's also the Deleuze and Guattari that we perhaps most associate with them, so a privileging of rhizomatic flows, resistance and escape from all structurations of power, and the politicization of life itself, a life that cannot be contained in any form or any structure of any kind. It's also the Deleuze and Guattari that has enjoyed the most attention, both in the academy and beyond, insofar as the concepts of the war machine, the rhizome, nomads, and becoming have seemed to coincide most readily with the kinds of horizontalist social movements that have defined our most recent sequence of struggles, from the ultra-globalization movement to Occupy Wall Street and beyond. So this is the first Deleuze and Guattari. The second Deleuze and Guattari, less pronounced but no less present, is characterized by a concern with the subjective act of inscribing transformations in subjectivity into new social orders and institutions. So this is a Deleuze and Guattari that gesture towards the essential role that political organizations, social structures, and modes of production play in the perpetuation or defeat of a revolutionary consciousness. It is therefore, I think, a Deleuze and Guattari for whom revolution remains an incomplete political project that is as impossible to anticipate as it is an ever-present possibility, and the Deleuze and Guattari who I want to claim may be of some assistance for thinking through today's resurgence of interest, at least in the UK, in things like base unions, base building, the party form, and indeed, I think, the struggle against fossil fuel infrastructures and climate change, which is my own research. Here, however, matters are a little more complicated. Though Deleuze and Guattari are undeniably anti-capitalist and remain to the end self-proclaimed Marxists, they never go so far as to endorse, or for that matter, to even think revolution as a radical break, or for that matter, a properly prescriptive politics of any kind. Rather, in their more overtly political texts and passages, Deleuze and Guattari hesitate on the threshold between philosophy and politics. So what I argue in the full version of this paper is that it's precisely at this point on the uneasy juncture between their philosophy and their more occasional political remarks that a rapprochement between their theorization of becoming revolutionary and the practice of a militant communist politics proper can become possible. Somewhat paradoxically, however, it only becomes possible on the condition that we recognize Deleuze and Guattari's philosophy does not have a politics, but that, to use Badiou's language for a moment, it is conditioned by a politics. What Deleuze and Guattari aim to do is record the consequences of political struggle, of alterations to the composition of capital within philosophical concepts. So I think once that's observed, the concept of becoming revolutionary can be reread as the conceptualization of a particular moment in political struggle, of a particular set of concrete conditions, and that it therefore contains within it all the ambiguities, hesitations, and uncertainties that come with the practice of political struggle itself. Hence, I would suggest the existence of these two contradictory Deleuze and Guattari's that I'm trying to draw out. So I'm not going to be able to cover all of that in extensive detail today, right? So what I want to do is introduce the idea that their philosophy proceeds on the basis it doesn't have a politics, and why that might be important when thinking about these thinkers. Then turn to their concept of becoming revolutionary to demonstrate how Deleuze and Guattari's way of doing philosophy allows them to make a considerable contribution to Marxist philosophy in particular, and to revolutionary theory, by developing a particular account of the temporality of a revolutionary situation. Then, if I have time, I'm going to wrap up by briefly locating these ambiguities in their thought. Okay, so beginning with the idea that Deleuze and Guattari's philosophy does not have a politics, a claim that I want to make clear is not the same as saying that they were not involved in politics, they very much were, or that their philosophy is not conditioned by a particular political sequence, it definitely was. The point rather is that no particular political program, no political prescription, can be said to follow from Deleuze and Guattari's philosophy. Rather, as they themselves say at various points, they give us a practical philosophy, a meta-model, a diagramming of forces, or a pragmatics. It's precisely because Deleuze and Guattari give us an apolitical but practical philosophy that their thought has been claimed or put to use by political positions from the left and right. And just to give you an indication, Todd May and Sal Newman claim to have found an anarchist Deleuze, Nicholas Thoburn and Andrew Culp, a communist Deleuze, Paul Patton and Nicholas Tampio, a liberal Deleuze, Rosie Bradotti, a post-humanist Deleuze, William Connolly, a radical democratic Deleuze. Beyond those readings, we shouldn't forget people such as Nick Land and their far-rightist neo-reactionary interpretation, or the fact that the Israeli Defense Force found Deleuze and Guattari's discussion of smooth and striated space of assistance in developing their urban warfare strategies and thus their settler colonial project more generally. So the fact that such varied political perspectives can be read into Deleuze and Guattari should tell us something important about their philosophy. However, rather than considering this a weakness of their thought, as some tend to, I want to suggest that it points very precisely to the limits of philosophy itself. With Lenin, Mao, Cabral, Althusser, Badiou, and Lazarus, I want to suggest that only militant practitioners of politics can think politics, and furthermore, Deleuze and Guattari's utility to Marxist philosophy rests on the possibility of making them commensurate with that position. So what I want to suggest again, following Althusser and Badiou, is that we ought to see Deleuze and Guattari's concepts as the recording of politics in philosophy, or as Badiou puts it in his own definition of philosophy, philosophy is not a theory of politics, but a sui generis activity of thought, which finds itself conditioned by the events of real politics, and which Badiou says draws new lines of petition, thinks new distinctions, and verifies the shifting of the political condition. So it's in that vein that I think we should understand Deleuze and Guattari's own argument that philosophy's sole aim is to become worthy of the event. Here, event doesn't mean the Badiouan event, but it nevertheless does mean the new that emerges, as Deleuze and Guattari say, here and now in the struggle against capitalism, and from which it is the task of philosophy to create new concepts. So those familiar with these two thinkers will know that that's their definition of philosophy, just the creation of new concepts. What puts Deleuze and Guattari on the terrain of Marxist philosophy, but to be clear, not communist politics, is their disdain for both parliamentary democracy and the idea that through the public expression of opinion, or what Jody Dean has called communicative capitalism, we can reach the kind of consensus that would allow us to respond to the crises that confront us today. As they say, philosophy cannot find the condition for the invention of concepts in the present form of the democratic state or in the cogito of communication. We do not lack communication. On the contrary, we have too much of it. We lack creation. We lack resistance to the present. For Deleuze and Guattari, then, a Marxist philosophy has two requirements. First, that it connect up with struggles against capitalism that are taking place here and now. Second, that it rejects the idea of liberal consensus and instead, as they say, calls for a future form, for a new earth, and a people that do not yet exist, to which we in this room might want to give the name communism, I would suggest. Marx's philosophy is therefore situated on the juncture between the present and an anticipated future. Or as Andrew Culp puts it for Deleuze and Guattari, philosophy does not represent reality, but provides a fresh orientation to the problems of this world. You get? Yeah, cool, okay. So it's in this key that I want to read their concept of becoming revolutionary. What we find in this concept is the recording of a political problem in philosophy, to restate, a problem that we are still very much wrestling with today. How do we think revolution? Can we still think revolution in light of the limits reached by the Russian and Chinese revolutions and perhaps the 68? Deleuze and Guattari's concept of becoming revolutionary does not resolve that problem, it merely marks it for our attention. So with all of that said, the kind of context of situating them within philosophy, I want to turn to this idea of becoming revolutionary to talk about, one, the contribution that it makes, and two, to show these kind of ambiguities of these two accounts. So I think it makes several contributions, but the way in to maybe for this room is to think about the distinction that they make between becoming and history. Because I think it's one of their most notable contributions, but it's also the space where this ambiguity between their two accounts of becoming revolutionary is most evident. So to quote just two lines from Deleuze and Guattari to get us into this. First, it's fashionable these days to condemn the horrors of revolution. It's nothing new. English Romanticism is permeated by reflections on Cromwell, very similar to present-day reflections on Stalin. They say revolutions turn out badly, but they're constantly confusing two different things. The way revolutions turn out historically, and a people's revolutionary becoming. Second, becoming isn't a part of history. History amounts only to a set of preconditions, however recent, one leaves behind in order to become, that is, to create something new. So I think these are extremely carefully formulated passages that raise questions both about the relationship between becoming and history and about revolutionary agency. But I want to focus only on the issue of history here, and we can perhaps talk about agency in the questions and answers. So it's an open question in the secondary literature whether this gap between becoming and history is an insurmountable one, so that becomings are a creative ahistorical process operating beneath and apart from history, or whether becoming is better thought of as internal to history, as a sub-historical process, so to speak, that might inscribe itself back into history. What is certain is that Deleuze and Guattari aim to rid their idea of becoming revolutionary from all traces of teleological thought or historicist accounts of causality. As they write in A Thousand Plateaus, unlike history, becoming cannot be conceptualized in terms of the past and future. Becoming revolutionary remains indifferent to questions of a future and a past of revolution. It passes between the two. Every becoming is a block of coexistence. So their target in that respect is most clearly a somewhat impoverished, or in Isabel Garrow's estimations, strawmanned reading of Marxist and Hegelian accounts of history. But it is a misunderstanding that nevertheless allows them to contribute to these discussions almost against themselves. Becoming revolutionary for the two philosophers comes with no guarantee. It is a wager or a risk that takes place against a backdrop of a concrete situation, but that is not of the situation. As they say in their short piece, May 68 did not take place, becoming revolutionary is an event that breaks with history, that is irreducible to any social determinism or causal chain. So I think this idea can be somewhat difficult to grasp for those of us with a background in history, and indeed Deleuze and Guattari quip that historians are not very fond of this point, that they work to restore causality after the fact. But for Deleuze and Guattari, this kind of step outside of conventional linear causality is essential if we're going to explain what's radically new in a situation. As they say, at such moments, everything is played in uncertain games, by which they mean that the political field is radically open. Whatever comes to pass will have been strictly unforeseeable in terms of its past, and it will be uninscribable within a teleological account of the revolution as the so-called end of history. So this focus on becoming revolutionary of a people in an empty form of time, on the profound uncertainty of a revolutionary situation, or on its ahistoricity, draws Deleuze and Guattari into an analysis of what they call the micropolitics, or molecular processes of becoming revolutionary. These are the minor details, or the subjective redeployments, as they say, that suggest something is about to happen, has already happened, or better, is becoming. For example, they quote Gabriel Tarde's observation that the French Revolution was on the cards from the moment that peasants ceased to greet landowners with the doff of a cap. The same, they say, occurred in 68. Those who looked for the macro-political conditions of revolution within the unions, the parties, factories, or the state missed what was essential. To say that the conditions were not right in 68 is to miss that something new and entirely unexplainable in terms of the past was taking place on a molecular level. We might also want to think of Trotsky's description of the beginning of the Russian Revolution. Trotsky describes, preempting Deleuze and Guattari's own language to a certain extent, that in every factory, in each guild, in each company, in each tavern, at the military hospital, at transfer stations, even in depopulated villages, the molecular work of revolutionary thought was in progress. Everywhere were to be found interpreters of events, chiefly among the workers, from whom one inquired, "What's the news?" and from whom one awaited the needed words. Elements of experience, criticism, initiative, self-sacrifice seeped down through the mass and created invisibly to a superficial glance, but no less decisively, an inner mechanics of the revolutionary movement as a conscious process. So this, I would suggest, is an early account of the micropolitics of the Russian Revolution. Deleuze and Guattari's attentiveness to such moments, an attentiveness that refuses to fall either into a naive historicism or a brute empiricism, is laudable. Their separation of becoming from history tells us to attend in our own thinking and practice to these molecular processes, to what is radically new, what is inexplicable within a revolutionary situation or within any form of struggle, irrespective of the eventual outcome of becoming revolutionary. For Deleuze and Guattari, it is here in the ahistorical time of the event, in the subjective redeployments that a becoming revolutionary inaugurates, that the revolution will principally have its effects, and not at the macro political level of the party, the state, or of history. As they say, the victory of a revolution is imminent and consists in the new bonds it installs between people, even if these bonds last no longer than the revolution's fused material and quickly give way to division and betrayal. Okay, and yet, to begin wrapping up, we can perhaps already see that such pronouncements seem to reintroduce a teleology of their own, that of the necessary defeat, betrayal, and co-optation of becoming revolutionary, only to be followed by its renewal under new conditions. From this perspective, the passage from becoming revolutionary to revolution is as irrelevant as it is unthinkable. What matters is that the revolution inscribes itself in the virtual field of events ready to be repeated once more with a difference further down the line. And this is the kind of argument that people like Peter Horwood will level and just throw Deleuze and Guattari out for. So there's therefore a real danger, I think, that despite their considerable contributions to thinking revolution, Deleuze and Guattari risk endorsing an interminable deferral of revolution in the name of transitory acts of resistance. For Isabel Garrow, such politics is symptomatic of, quote, the widely shared feeling of failure in the wake of 68, or what Peter Starr has called the logic of failed revolt. So with Garrow and Starr, we can say that Deleuze and Guattari's concept of becoming revolutionary captures, records within philosophy, the post-68 moment of revolutionary defeat. And yet, to stop here, I would suggest, is to miss the ambiguity of Deleuze and Guattari's position. Okay. Here and there in their thought, there is recognition that the intervention or an intervention to institutions and new forms of organization or new modes of production have to be made to record becoming revolutionary in history. This line is most forcefully articulated in their seminal 1984 essay, May 68 Did Not Take Place. Here, Deleuze and Guattari's argument is that while 68 marks a rupture in subjectivity, and indeed in French society, the reaction against May 68 ensured that these could not find support in new organizational arrangements. For Deleuze and Guattari, it is precisely because the new forms of subjectivity produced by 68 have not found institutional support that the event can be said to have not taken place, at least not yet. May 68 remains the insurmountable virtual impasse of French society from this position. It is the deadlock around which even its contemporary social composition is structured. So the only way out of such an impasse, Deleuze and Guattari imply, is to repeat 68 under new conditions, to push the becoming revolutionary further, to make a mark on history. It is in such passages that a different Deleuze and Guattari surfaces, one that, without going into detail, because I'm going to run out of time, recognises the need for a seizure and repurposing of institutions and existing stratifications of power. It is a Deleuze and Guattari for whom the actualisation of the revolution is still our most urgent task. So these are the two I'm trying to pull out. One where they cannot imagine revolution and one where revolution remains an open question, not for certain, but an ambiguity that we should work towards in the present. That's pretty much it. Right.
Would you score it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, everyone is trying to find a zone of comfort in this room.
Switch out.
I'll start my presentation. My name is Jonathan Masnoa. I'm from and based in Montreal. I teach at the Department of Politics and International Studies at Bishop's University, which is in Sherbrooke, just close to Montreal. I'm the person who wrote the book on time. I don't know if it's good. It's decent. I say it's decent. I think it's for sale. If we're gonna plug it, might as well do it. It's for sale.
The
title is "Time, Capitalism, and Alienation," and it's for sale. It's with Haymarket. So it's the Haymarket version of the HM series, and it's there. And I think I'm making 22 cents each time you buy a copy. So, I'm not going to talk about my book today, but I'm going to talk about some themes that I've been working on since the book. So these are obviously related to what I've discussed in the book, but perhaps some more recent angles and really some explorations mainly on the theme of, well, temporal alienation, which I have worked on in the book, but I want to approach the question then from the angle of the concept of social acceleration, a concept which has been gaining momentum, pun intended, in the social sciences, and about which I'm still very much ambivalent, to be honest. And I'm trying to get my head around, see what can be useful or not in this approach. And I'm going to refer to one of the most important theorists of that contemporary social theory, Hartmut Rosa, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. And explore perhaps certain limits, certain problems that I found that are of particular interest to me in this type of theoretical apparatus, if you will. And especially try to bring in some directions of inquiry, criticisms, and arguments made by Judy Wachsman, a sociologist working here at LSC, if I'm not mistaken. So Rosa's work hardly needs introduction now. He's today pretty well-known everywhere in the world. His work is associated with the current generation of the Frankfurt School. His doctoral supervisor was Axel Arndt. He's very much influenced by Charles Taylor as well, by Max Weber. He's had his own TED Talk now, which I'm not sure is a good thing or not. But Rosa's work on social acceleration is fairly ambitious. For those of you who are familiar with his work, it aims at constructing a more or less comprehensive theory of modernity, and nothing less than that, and late modernity as well, under this frame of social acceleration. So it makes for a fairly ambitious read as well. So modernity for him is a process of social acceleration. And what he speaks and what he says is it speaks very much to the concept of capitalist market time, which I've been working with and working on. So that's how I started tentatively to look at his work. We can break down social acceleration in three fundamental levels, and that's from Rosa's work. The first level is what he calls a technical acceleration, which is defined as the acceleration of processes in sectors such as, you know, transports, communication, production, and they're all characterized by an increase in speed. Think of turnover time here as well, in Harvey's work probably. So here the idea is that the drive of capitalist competition to favor tech-intensive innovations has created an acceleration in technical times. It's quite simple concept here. The second level is the one of the acceleration of social change itself. So here the transformation occurs at the level of modes of social associations themselves. So in contrast to the first level, at the first level, it concerns acceleration of processes within society. But at the second level, here we're concerned with acceleration of society itself. That's the way Rosa puts it. So attitudes, values, lifestyles, social relations, responsibility, forms of communication, all these things change at an accelerated pace. And it results in this image, this illustration of the social landscape in constant flux. So family relations change faster, that's one example. Families are reconstituted after many times in one generation. Employment changes faster as well. So today, keeping the same job your entire life is kind of an exception, I guess, where it used to be more of a rule. So here, really, at the second level, it is the question of institutional stability, I think, that Rosa is trying to get at, which is the focus of acceleration. The third and final level is the one I'm going to focus on more for this presentation today. It concerns the acceleration of the life rhythm. And this is where, for me, this theory engages more directly with themes I'm interested in, which come back to this crucial question of temporal alienation, temporal loss, our relationship to time, our experience of time as a scarce resource, as something on which we have so little control, except on panels where we have, in which we're always out of. So I always like to talk about this topic in conference settings because it's readily tangible of how we run out of time and we need to speed up and all these things. So anyways, so I'm going to spare you the usual jokes I make on all presentations I do on this. So this third level, then, of acceleration of the life rhythm, it gestures to, and in Rose's work, and you'll see there would be, I think, some comparisons to be made with some stuff that Jameson says as well and a bunch of other authors. He talks about an increase of the quantity of episodes of action, or an increase in the quantity of experiences per time unit, right? Which obviously would be, well, quite odd to imagine from a concrete point of view, concrete time point of view, but it makes perfect sense in a system with abstract time units. If you have abstract time units, then you can fill them up with more experiences and more, more action. So it speaks to our individual lives, then, in which we experience more in less time. Something we can refer to, and I think he uses the term, intensification of the present. So obviously this is related, as I would suggest, or my intuition is that it's related, obviously, to the imperatives of productivity, which I've migrated from market times all the way to permeating our individual lives as well. Other ways in which to think of the third level here of acceleration, we spend less time on different activities. We eat our meals faster, we sleep less, we have shorter conversations with our loved ones. We have altogether shorter attention span, so by now you're not listening to me anymore. So these things are all other ways in which I think Rose is trying to make sense of this third level. And here the idea of multitasking also is they're telling. We do several things at once, which amounts to the same, spending less time doing one particular thing. So the final picture here of social acceleration at that level, at that third level, is a tragic one. When you read Rosa, there's a sense of tragedy. There's a rush of experience. There's an intensification, a compression of the present that do not lead us to live more meaningful lives. It's translated into an experience of temporal alienation, a feeling of loss of time. So temporal alienation here, and what struck me when I read this, is it can also be understood in more ethical terms, if you will, as an alienation from our own actions as well. This is linked with the intensification of the present, then, in the sense that we have less time to think through our actions and more information to compute every time we need to act. So our actions, if we have less time to think through them, are less ours in that sense, a sense of alienation. Here they are less the product of a deliberation that would be given its proper time. And of course, one other form is alienation from other people, obviously. And here Rosa refers to the difficulty of establishing long-term relationships, both in our social lives, private lives, but professionally as well, in this flexible, accelerated world. So the idea of temporal alienation as a product of acceleration, therefore, speaks to a disconnection between us, our lived times, as if we're having lots of experiences. More and more stimulations, possibilities, that's one aspect of accelerated society. But the traces that these experiences leave in our lives and our memories, so the identity formative aspect of contemporary experiential forms are lessened. So to put it simply, and I hope I'm not doing injustice to Rosa's argument here, is that we live lives that are quantitatively rich in experiences, but qualitatively poor in experiences. I think that's where he's trying to get at. So qualitatively, in the sense that experiences that shape our identities. Right? So this can all be linked to the domination of abstract clock time, first on work times, having made possible the very notion of productivity, doing more things in a given fixed amount of time. Well, this obviously requires abstract fixed time units, right? And then this domination also extending to the times of our lives. So injecting this notion of productivity and time as a thing not to be wasted in how we live our lives outside of the workplace, think of Weber, Protestant ethic, and all these things as well. So it's important to note that there are very important limits to this theory of social acceleration as well, that I'm still trying to grapple and to get my head around. So if you have any criticisms of that theory, any reading suggestions, please do after. Firstly, in Rose's work, at least, it describes, when you read it, it describes the experience of a male professional class, basically. So when he uses examples, it's basically, well, I went to a conference, and then I was late for my next flight, and then I had to, you know, respond to these hundreds of emails, which is not, you know, common experience for, you know, at least people around me. Except me, on certain days, I do have a life like this, like right now, but it speaks to a very particular social group, I would say. That's the first thing. Judy Waxman, which I mentioned at first, has brought very important criticisms here at that level. For example, this notion of acceleration is experienced very differently by women who remain responsible for most of domestic work, for example, as well as for people in precarious job situations, so they might experience alienation very differently in these conditions. Judy Waxman's book is called Pressed for Time, and she really opens up a very important discussion on the limits of Rose's work in this sense. So I strongly encourage you, if you're a reader of Rose, do read Waxman as well, because she opens up. So it's very important questions. The other main problem, and this is more like a theoretical problem, if you will, and it's the one I'm going to focus on for the rest of the presentation, is the kind of contested nature of empirical evidence for acceleration of life burdens. So it's just hard to make sense of empirically speaking. So you have empirical studies of time use data, for example, time use that show that acceleration is real, is widespread at the level of subjective experiences, but it remains difficult to substantiate it empirically in terms of actual time use data. So people feel time pressure, right? So when you do interviews and you ask people, and there are lots of sociological studies on that, they do feel it's across the board. And of all social groups, everyone has this experience. But the data of time use suggests that people have as much discretionary time as in previous periods. So for instance, people on average, don't work more hours. Of course, it varies in certain social groups, especially for precarious classes. But on average, people don't work more hours. People don't sleep less than at the start of the century. This data has been contested and debunked. But subjectively, so subjectively, people, when asked in interviews and surveys, say they feel out of time. I don't have time to do everything. But empirically, it's hard to substantiate. Or at least the studies are not conclusive. Let's put it that way. So the acceleration of the life rhythm is more of a subjective experience than something we can actually measure empirically on an uncontestable basis. So then the question becomes, why? Why are people experiencing that acceleration of their life rhythm across the board in such an overwhelming way? And I would like to share and use this opportunity to maybe share a very tentative start to an answer to that. And I'd suggest that the reason why people feel that their life rhythm is accelerating, if there's no quantitative basis for the claim, is to be found on the side of qualitative degradation of free time and of leisure time. So that's my hypothesis for now. Now, people feel out of time because leisure time, free time, has been colonized by market time and productivity imperatives. And therefore, the injunctions to be productive, the constant presence and pressure of the market in our lives, leaves us but little respite. So yes, I would like to turn this into a theoretical argument, but also an ethical argument of sorts as well. And what I mean here is that leisure time is extensively under the pressure of market time in our era. So let me explain a little bit what I mean here by when I say leisure time is extensively under the pressure of market time. Leisure time, you're familiar, it's a category that has taken many different forms, many different meanings throughout history. And at the risk of making historical generalizations, we can say that leisure time has mostly been historically a form of extra economic time. So a time outside of economic activity. For example, think of the leisure ideal of ancient Greek property males, very much the Eureta in Aristotle's writings, for example, on ethics. It emphasized a definition of leisure, so skole is the ancient Greek term, rooted in freedom from economic necessity. So scholarly was time outside of economic production, outside even, I would argue, in the Greek case of economic distribution and consumption. It was exempt from work, exempt from economic concern. That's the very definition of the term. A proper scholarly was actually restricted then to a specific social class and gender of oikos, also the masters, who did not have to engage in work, did not have to engage in economic production per se, since slaves and women were the ones who worked. And while the masters, and remember the ethics, Nicomachean ethics, and the masters provide rational guidance, exert authority, but do not work. So scholarly was therefore time spent outside of economic activities, an extra economic time, and reserved for property males for activities such as, you know, philosophy, conversation, symposium, right? Gymnastics, study, so on. So it's a time of tranquility. It's a time of, especially in Aristotle's version, it's a time of creative contemplation, leisure, but also social activities, getting drunk with, you know, Plato and Socrates and his friends. Right? So, and it's understood in Aristotle as a requirement for eudaimonia, as a requirement for the good life. You need leisure, you need scholarship, right? And we can say very much similar things. I'll spare you the history of leisure time, but we can say very similar things about leisure time in the Roman world. The notion here is the notion of otium. It's discussed in Cicero, for example, and a bunch of other authors. It's strongly marked off from many economic activities. In Cicero's definition, it looks like a sabbatical year when he talks about otium and leisure time. So really, same thing with the practices of leisure for both noble popular classes in the Middle Ages and so on. So leisure time historically as an extra economic time, in the sense of outside of work, outside of production of life necessities or economic concerns. And then what happens to leisure time with the advent of capitalism and capitalist time is actually very interesting. At first, leisure time, there's a wonderful book by Cunningham, which I reviewed a year or two ago on the evolution of leisure time here in England, but I think he makes arguments that can be, you know, spread across the board. So leisure time is mostly spent at first when capitalism, especially industrial capitalism, emerges. Leisure time is mostly kept outside of the sphere of economics at first. So in continuation with historical tradition. So especially through the institutionalization of what we call the 8-8-8 regime. So that's the separation of the day between 8 hours of work, 8 hours of leisure, 8 hours of sleep, in which leisure in that model is understood as non-work, okay. So as non-productive time. And then leisure time, under the pressure of capitalist time and market time, becomes, through the history of capitalism, more and more subjected to the markets. Okay. So it becomes more and more of an economic time here. And let me perhaps emphasize that passage a little bit. This 8-8-8 time regime was institutionalized in many countries in the modern period. It's an early demand of labor movements. It became a rallying cry for many unions, labor federations, from the US to France to Australia, a bunch of places. And such daytime divisions were accompanied by a shaping of the week as well. So Saturdays were not holidays before. They became progressively half holidays at first in the later part of the 19th century, and then full holidays only after World War II. So our Saturdays off are a quite recent thing. Sundays also underwent transformation. It was mostly a religious rest day and became more a recreative day. And that's the Cunningham book I'm talking about, which traces that shaping of the week and of the days. And this led to a separation between an economic work time and an extra economic leisure time, as separate time blocks to be spent in different spaces and practices. And this clean separation between work time as a block of time uniquely spent on or at work, and then leisure time uniquely spent in leisure activities outside of the workplace. The separation became predominant in the industrial capitalist time regime, if you will. So at first, in capitalist societies, leisure time is still understood as a time during which one engages in hobbies, cultural activities, rest, sports, socialization, family life, and obviously for working women and housewives who also are predominantly performing domestic work, there's very little or no leisure time at all. And that's also an argument you find in Bachman, very much substantiated and very interesting. So what happens progressively then from the 19th century on, though, in parallel with the consolidation of this 8-8-8 time regime, is the rise of industrialized mass culture, mass consumption. And this gives rise in return to a vast process of commercialization of leisure activities. And there's a vast literature on this, and identifies really the rise of sports and entertainment industries, really as key processes in the transformation of leisure time into a time for commercialized entertainment. And through this twin process, so you have commercialization of leisure, the rise of entertainment, what happens is that leisure time becomes tied to capitalist markets in an increasing way. So there's a penetration of leisure by the market here. So of leisure time by economic time, which has deepened today by all accounts. So there's a whole new phase discussing leisure time studies, experiential consumerism, commercialized entertainment practices. The way people spend their leisure time is increasingly so. You know, the first leisure activity in Canada, the U.S., the U.K. is spent using entertainment appliances. All data shows that watching TV, video games are the main ones now, but also social media, etc. So it's not an overstatement to suggest that entertainment activities, which are mostly, that's another point made in the literature, passive in nature, have taken hold of leisure time in our period. So through these processes, time spent outside of work is not necessarily equivalent to time spent outside market practices. So in contrast with most of our historical understandings and practices of leisure, leisure time in late capitalism is not an extra economic time anymore. In the precise sense that it is a time that has increasingly become mediated by the market. So this is apparent in the rise of the mass culture industry, obviously. This is also apparent in, if you think of leisure time as well, my argument here would be, if I have time to substantiate this argument one day, it's not just about consumption. It's not just about that leisure is linked to the market because we consume stuff, right? So because you buy stuff online, because you're in the social media, and then your attention is being sold. So that's also productive, right? It's producing value. Your attention is worth something, right, that is sold on the market. So that's one way as well in which leisure, by producing attention, has been tied to the market. The other example I wanted to mention here is the example of the data, personal data collection industry. I think it's the most revealing example. Penetration of leisure times by market time. So production of personal data through our online commercialized leisure activity. So the market and personal information is one of the fastest growing markets in the US today. It's very little regulated, actually, and it really speaks to what I'm trying to get at with the idea of the constant tendency of market time to penetrate our lived times, to commodify our times, even times which are historically meant to be kept outside of economic compulsion. Right? So there's a very important way in which new technologies, flexibilization of work hours also play into that, obviously having to respond to emails during the, you know, that's also a form of having your leisure time tied to the market. I'm pressed by time, obviously.
Yes.
So I'm going to end with so to tie this up together with my original question. If we can make a case for considering contemporary leisure time as increasingly a market time, and in this sense, even if leisure time is time spent not working, it is still thoroughly economicized and commodified. So both work time and leisure time share that common characteristic of being under the pressure of capitalist market time and productivity compulsion. So to me, the fact that our free time is so much tied to the pressures, the imperatives of capitalist market regime and capitalist market time and growth, it might explain in part at least why people feel so out of time. Our work time is siphoned by the market, and our leisure time as well, right? Which leaves us little time for true respite, self-realization, eudaimonia, whatever you want to call it, outside of that frantic pace of economic compulsion all the time. So I would look into, if I had more time, I would look into the deterioration of this quality, not the quantity, but the quality of leisure time as perhaps a factor that could help explain why people feel out of time, even if we can't substantiate this claim empirically speaking. So that's all that. Thank you for your patience.
Switch. Is that right?
Second?
Yeah.
Cool.
So, hi, my name is Juha Koivisto, and I come from Tampere, Finland. And of my background, it was mentioned that I've worked quite long for this huge German project of History of a Critical Dictionary of Marxism. And in this this talk, this is a little summary of one of the kind of main themes. I decided to use this slide since my English is not at all as good as that of my co-speakers, so I thought that this might be of some help for you in understanding what I'm saying. So what I'm talking about is a certain shift from Hobbes' more narrowly state-centered view of organizing opinion to a more hegemonic view, relying more on the initiatives of civil society, represented by Locke, Shaftesbury, and Hume. And in Gramscian language, we could talk about the shift in the direction of an integral state as an integral combination of force and consent. And this shift also tries to tackle the problem of potential lack of inner conviction on the part of the subject, signaled by Hobbes, by stressing the development of trust and consent, as well as the initiative and work of the subject on themselves, all connected to the hegemonic apparatuses on which there's this entry in the dictionary on hegemonic apparatus, also translated in the HM. Also, hegemonic apparatus of the emerging bourgeois society. For those of you who are more accustomed to the Althusserian language, we could perhaps translate this following way. If we think about the break that Hobbes represents, in breaking with the older Aristotelian connection between physics, nature, form, and telos, by showing that the state is artificial, the problem that follows is that both the construction of the sovereign and of the subject, it becomes a project, because they are artificial projects. They are not natural. So the problem is how to produce them. So to continue in the Althusserian language, we have the big subject S, the sovereign, and the small subject S, the small subjects. And well, of course, here we play with the word subject because it has a double meaning, as in Althusser. It's a play on words, because the subject means both a kind of thing that we think, or at least imagine, that we are the origin of our actions. That's the active side. And then there's this other side of subject as being, well, in German, Untertan. And that you get perhaps by imagining the Queen of Britain speaking to her subjects, or reading Anthony Burgess write in one of his novels, "You can't put me under arrest, I'm a subject of the British crown." So that's got kind of what we are talking about. So, and one of the kind of main dimensions is the question about organizing opinion, and about force and relation between force and content. And so here, what David Hume writes: obedience and subjection, according to David Hume, are so familiar that most men never make any inquiry about its origin or cause, more than about the principle of gravity, resistance, or the most universal laws of nature. And Hume's statement seems to have lost none of its pertinence today. He wrote that nothing appears more surprising to those who consider human affairs with a philosophical eye than the easiness with which the many are governed by the few. And in depicting the reasons behind this wonder, he brings in the dialectic between force and opinion. And here's a citation from him. When we inquire by what means this wonder is effected, we shall find that as force is always on the side of the governed, the governors have nothing to support them but opinion. It is therefore on opinion only that government is founded. And this maxim extends to the most despotic and military governments, as well as to most free and most popular. The Sultan of Egypt, or the Emperor of Rome, might drive his harmless subject, like brute beasts, against their sentiments and inclination, but he must, at least, have led his mamelukes or Praetorian bands like men by their opinion. And he notes that especially the stability of modern governments relies on opinion, or that it's this concept is as widespread as possible, because it's hard to organize a modern society solely on despotic basis. Because that would be contrary to any rule of law or anything like that. Already for Hobbes, the ultimate reason for the importance of ideological powers and their regulation of opinions is that the power of the mind hath no foundation but in the opinion and belief of the people. If men know not their duty, what is there that can force them to obey laws? An army, you will say, but what shall force the army? Now, for Hobbes, there are certain rules, like in arithmetics and in geometry, how to build this construction, this state. And he knows that there are these rules, and they are not based on just on practice like tennis play. He was a very avid tennis player, still at the age of 75, by the way. So, according to Hobbes, the actions of men proceed from opinions, and in the well-governing of opinions consists that the well-governing of men's actions in order to their peace and concord. That is, it is annexed to the sovereignty to be judged of what opinions and doctrines are averse and what conducing to peace, and consequently, on what occasions, how far, and what men are to be trusted withal, in speaking to multitude of people who shall examine the doctrines of all books before they are published. As you see, this sounds frighteningly authoritarian. There's a tight control. He's not at all unsophisticated. Namely, this guy invented this doctrine of two-step flow of communication that it was found in the communication studies 300 years later as the big invention in the mid 1950s in the USA. Namely, for Hobbes, the dangerous widespread opinion of the distribution of power was behind the civil war in England. He was strongly for the rooting out of the consciences of men all those opinions which seem to justify and give pretense to the right of rebellious actions. Thoughts that you may entertain here. However, according to Hobbes, opinions which are gotten by education and in length of time are made habitual, cannot be taken away by force, and upon sudden they must therefore be taken away also by the time and education, not least because of the social division of labor linked to the necessities of subsistence. It is the universities that play the crucial role in these chains, mediated by what in media research was later invented as the two-step flow model, or in the more sophisticated way as multi-step flow model. So here is how he formulates it. They whom, and here is your conscience ringing. They whom necessity your covenants keepeth attends to their trades and labor, and they on the other side, whom superfluity or sloth carrieth after their sensual pleasures, which two sorts of men take up the greatest part of mankind, being diverted from the deep meditation which the leaning of truth, not only in the matter of natural justice, but also of all other choices requireth, receive the notions of their duties chiefly from the divines in the pulpit, and partly from such of their neighbors or familiar acquaintance as having the faculty of discoursing readily and plausibly seem wiser and better learned in cases of law and conscience than themselves, and divines and such other as make show of learning derive their knowledge from the universities and from the schools of law or from the books which by men eminent in those schools and universities have been published. Now, perhaps we move forward to Locke. And what is interesting, one thing that is very interesting in Locke is the topic of conformism. For Locke, human conformism or sociability, including human passions and interests, also extend to processes of knowledge. Accordingly, the most damaging pattern that keeps in ignorance or error more people than all other together is giving up our assent to the common received opinions, either of our friends or party, neighborhood or country. This extends also to the intellectuals in the world of learning and politics. Of course, the Locke's model is much more based on the agrarian capitalist economy and its trade of commodities that needs some basic trust. I mean the exchange of commodities and how this can be expanded to the informal state, and how the state must rely on this sort of broader consent that has its basis in civil society and not in the state itself. So here's a fundamental shift from Hobbes. And this is how his kind of project of creating new kind of conformism and creating a intellectual reform is linked to his critique of conformism and his ideas about the sociability of men. But it's interesting that later Locke's scrutiny and critique of the conformist social formation of opinions disappears from the view as, let's say, philosophically uninteresting, when much more narrowly conceived theory of knowledge, a product of the identity post-Hegelian identity crisis of philosophy in the 19th century, is projected on his work. So one of my theses is that we have actually much poorer picture of Locke than what kind of guy he actually was. Also a man of action, a spy and stuff like that. Very interesting stuff. Certain James Bond-like qualities. Plotting revolution in France and Holland and so on, and leading the security services astray by praising the French wines when actually he was in Holland plotting the revolution and drinking beer. Now, Gramsci has pointed out that everybody is a conformist, since we all belong to the same group that shares a common way of thinking and acting. Yet from Gramsci, conformism does not necessarily mean kowtowing or passivity. For him, conformism means simply social being. Conformism means nothing other than sociability. I like to use the word conformist precisely in order to irritate the imbeciles. For Gramsci, socially conformist is the result of cultural struggle and not only cultural. He writes that we experience an ongoing struggle between conformists, that is a struggle over hegemony. And I claim that Locke was very much part of that. And like later, Shaftesbury, his pupil, in very strong sense of the word. After all, he even arranged the marriage of his of the Shaftesbury's parents. He was a man of action. For Gramsci, the analytic difference between civil society and political society can be understood as a difference between self-government and government of the functionaries. The advance of the bourgeoisie to become a ruling class cannot be grasped solely as the setting free of the homo economicus, but as a movement to create a new civilization, a new type of man and citizen. In its most developed forms, this has meant efforts to encircle the political society with a complex and well-articulated civil society in which the individual governs himself without this self-government entering into conflict with political society, but rather becoming the normal continuation of it, its organic complement. This is very important, I think. Very important idea. And it compares very interestingly with, let's say, Foucauldian ideas. And it's strange that Gramsci's ideas, they have received relatively little attention compared to how people are so keen on what Foucault has written. From a Gramscian point of view, we could speak about a production of a new, more critical form of social conformism. By carrying on the old Socratic tradition of knowing oneself and employing some of the vocabulary later used by Gramsci in his revolutionary project, Shaftesbury, who incidentally spent the last period of his life in Naples, highlights the importance of improving one's coherence by building on one's good sense. He envisioned in the British conditions of legal monarchy, people would be all serious in the government of themselves. And I think this Naples connection is very interesting because it's very surprising that you find so many same vocabulary, of course not in the quite same sense as in Gramsci, in Shaftesbury. And this is I think, would be an interesting topic to make further research, what sort of possible connection there is. But it seems to me that could it be just an accident? So here's another interesting quotation that gives food for thought by Gramsci. The revolution that the bourgeois class has brought into the conception of law and hence into the function of state consists especially in the will of conformism, hence ethicity of the law of the state. The previous ruling classes were essentially conservatives in the sense that they did not tend to construct an organized passage from the other classes into their own, that is, to enlarge their class sphere technically or ideologically. Their conception was that of closed class. The bourgeois class processed itself as an organism in continuous movement, capable of absorbing the entire society, assimilating it to its own cultural and economic level. The entire function of the state has been transformed. The state has become an educator. And here, I think it's more fruitful to understand the state in an integral sense. And this is a very interesting idea. And I think that this this development from Locke to Shaftesbury, I could only give a you very small sketch. I left out very, very many beautiful citations and some very humorous citations too, because of time reasons. I think it sketches out this sort of development, where much more weight is put on the self, so to speak, self initiative of the subjects, and on the various practices of the civil society and state, understood in a broader sense, and the role of force is getting less important compared to how it was in Hobbes. And also the control of opinion is not anymore so centrally controlled from above, like in Hobbes, but it's more a question of processes of civil society and so on. So I think we can detect here an interesting process of transformation in philosophy. And of course, we have here emphasized the political importance of philosophy, and made also a certain implicit critique of the later projections of like say the theory of knowledge back to the history of philosophy. Thank you.